From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Where there's life, there's the ability to continuously strive to do whatever your purpose is or goal is in life. So, yes, if I'm alive, I can always strive forward to prove my innocence, regardless of how long it takes.
Today, a conversation with death row prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams from his cell in San Quentin. He helped start the Crips street gang, his greatest regret. But behind bars, he's become a leading advocate for the end of gang violence. He's written 9 books, has been nominated several times for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's scheduled to die on December 13th, unless Governor Schwarzenegger grants him clemency. Then, on the 10th anniversary of the arrest of U.S. citizen Lori Berenson in Peru, her father, Mark Berenson, reads a statement she released from her prison cell.
People all over the world are in prison today and suffering tremendous injustices for challenging this order. I express my solidarity with all of those prisoners.
But first, video is released of 4 kidnapped peace activists in Iraq.
My name is Norman Campbell.
My name is Henry Susan.
My name is James Loney.
My name is Tom Fox.
We'll go to Baghdad to speak with the Christian Peacemakers team. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, 4 kidnapped Western peace activists are accused of being foreign spies in a video released by their captors Tuesday night. The Arabic television network Al Jazeera broadcast a videotape of the 4 men sitting cross-legged against a wall with their hands behind their backs. The hostages are members of the Christian Peacemakers team, a humanitarian group based in Chicago. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel responded to the kidnapping of a German archaeologist by saying her government would not be blackmailed. In a video released to the German media, kidnappers threatened Suzanne Osthoff and her driver unless Germany breaks off all ties with the Iraqi government. We'll have more on the Iraq hostages in a few minutes. In Virginia, Governor Mark Warner has granted clemency to a convict who would have become the 1,000th person executed in the United States since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976. Less than 24 hours before he was to be executed, Robin Lovett's death sentence was commuted to life in prison. Governor Warner noted evidence from Lovett's trial had been improperly destroyed, preventing DNA testing his defense team says could prove his innocence. In a statement, Governor Warner said, quote, "The Commonwealth must ensure that every time this ultimate sanction is carried out, it's done fairly." The 1,000 milestone is expected to be reached Friday when both North Carolina and South Carolina have executions scheduled. The Los Angeles Times reporting the U.S. military secretly paying Iraqi newspapers to publish American-written articles favorable to the U.S. presence in Iraq. The Times reports articles written by U.S. military, quote, information operations, are translated into Arabic and then placed in Iraqi newspapers with the help of Washington-based defense contractor the Lincoln Group. The articles are presented to an Iraqi audience as unbiased news accounts written by independent journalists. The Lincoln Group's contract is worth up to $100 million over 5 years. A senior Pentagon official commented, quote, "Here we are trying to create the principles of democracy in Iraq. Every speech we give in that country is about democracy, and we're breaking all the first principles of democracy when we're doing it." In London, 2 people appeared in court Tuesday to face charges they violated the Official Secrets Act by leaking a memo that reportedly details a conversation between President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair over the possible bombing of Al Jazeera. David Keogh was charged with passing the memo to Leo O'Connor, who worked as an aide to the former British MP Tony Clark. The 2 are expected back in court in January. The Bangladesh city of Chittagong, 10 people were killed and 21 injured in what authorities called the country's first ever suicide bombings. Police accused the Islamic militant group Jamaatul Mujahideen of carrying out the attack. The suicide bomber survived the attack and is currently in intensive care. The bombing comes as U.S. and British embassies were closed in the capital city of Dhaka following threats from a group calling itself Al-Qaeda in South Asia. In Israel, sources close to political veteran Shimon Peres say he'll leave the Labor Party to back a new party formed by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Peres lost the Labor Party leadership to former UN union head Amir Peretz earlier this month. The support of Peres would be a major boost for Sharon, who left his own Likud party last week to form the new party Kadima, the Hebrew word for forward. Kadima released its party platform Monday. It says Israel will retain all of the major settlement blocks in the occupied West Bank. The French government announced new immigration measures Tuesday, it says, come in response to the country's recent civil unrest. Under the new regulations, authorities will tighten enforcement of existing requirements mandating immigrants to master the French language and integrate into society. The government says it'll also intensify the screening process for foreign students and crack down on fraudulent marriages. The measures were met with heavy criticism from human rights groups. Hassan Fall of the anti-racism group SOS Racism told Associated Press, quote, "This measure will make everyone suspicious of any marriage between a French citizen and a foreigner. Does the government want to suppress the possibility of mixed marriages?" In media news, Harper's Magazine announced Tuesday longtime editor Louis Lapham will be stepping down in the spring. Lapham has run the magazine for nearly 30 years. He'll be replaced by the deputy editor, Roger Hodge. He'll continue to write a monthly column. The change at Harper's comes 1 week after The Nation announced the retirement of publisher Victor Navasky. He'll remain on the magazine's editorial board. Nation editor Katrina Vandenhoevel has taken over as publisher. And the Supreme Court will hear arguments today that observers expect to shed new light on Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts' views on abortion. The case deals with a New Hampshire parental notification law that an appeals court ruled was unconstitutional. The case will be heard as the Senate Judiciary Committee prepares to consider the nomination of Judge Samuel Alito. 20 years ago, Alito said there was no constitutional right to abortion. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the case of death row prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams. In just under 2 weeks, on December 13th, the 51-year-old Williams is scheduled to be executed by the state of California. Williams is a convicted murderer, co-founder of one of the country's most notorious street gangs, the Crips. But since his incarceration, he's also become a Nobel Peace Prize-nominated children's author and a vocal advocate against gang violence. Stanley Tookie Williams' life now largely rests in the hands of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has the power to commute the death sentence. On December 8th, the governor will meet with Williams' defense team to hear its case for executive clemency. An international campaign to save Tookie Williams' life has also been growing. Actions are planned across the world today in what's been described as an International Save Tookie Day. In Los Angeles, hip-hop star Snoop Dogg and actor Jamie Foxx will join others in reading excerpts from Williams' books. Foxx starred in a film about Tookie's life entitled Redemption. To date, over 32,000 people have signed online petitions calling for Schwarzenegger to commute the death sentence. The story of Stanley Tookie Williams begins in the streets of Los Angeles in the early 70s. At the age of 17, he started the Crips street gang with his friend Raymond Washington. The gang would expand across the country and even overseas. In 1979, Williams was arrested in connection with four murders. He was convicted of shooting dead a 7-Eleven clerk named Albert Owens and of robbing and killing a Taiwanese motel owner along with his wife and daughter. He was sentenced in 1981 to four death sentences. Tookie Williams has always maintained his innocence and claims he received an unfair trial in part because he was convicted by an all-white jury. In 1993, Williams' life took a dramatic turn when he agreed to record a videotape message from death row supporting a truce between the Crips and the Bloods. The videotape was shown during a peace summit meeting attended by over 400 gang members.
Working together, we can put an end to this cycle that creates deep pain in the hearts of our mothers, our fathers, and our people who have lost loved ones to this senseless violence.
After Tookie Williams addressed the Hands Across Watts Gang Peace Summit in 1993, he became more involved in helping to keep young people out of gangs. With the help of his main advocate, Barbara Becknell, Williams soon began writing children's books and speaking with young people about the gang life. He also helped orchestrate truces between gangs. While his court appeals have largely been exhausted, judges have publicly admitted there's a strong case for clemency. In 2002, a three-judge panel on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld his death sentence, but in a rare move urged then-Governor Gray Davis to consider commuting the death sentence. The judges praised Tookie Williams for his, quote, laudable efforts opposing gang violence and his, quote, good works and accomplishments since incarceration. On Tuesday, I had a chance to interview Stanley Tookie Williams from death row in San Quentin. He called us collect on a phone monitored by prison officials. Hello, Stanley Williams?
Yes, it is.
It's Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!
Okay.
Thank you for joining us. I know you don't have much time, so I want to ask why you are petitioning the governor for executive clemency.
My attorneys are petitioning the governor because I am innocent, but primarily they're trying to save my life so that inevitably I will be able to prove my innocence.
Can you talk about the crime that you were convicted of? Are you guilty of that crime?
No, I am not culpable of those crimes. I've been stating that fact from the incipient, from the moment of my arrest, false arrest.
Why do you think the jury found you guilty?
Oh, it was quite easy. It was a paradigm of racism. We're talking about prosecutorial misconduct. We're talking about exclusion of exculpatory evidence. We're talking about IAC, which is ineffective assistance of counsel. We're talking about biased jury selection, which results in an all-white jury. We're talking about involuntary psychotropic druggings, the misuse of jailhouse and government informants. And last but not least...
This call and your telephone number will be recorded and monitored.
Not a shred of tangible evidence, no fingerprints, no crime scenes of bloody boot prints. They didn't match my boots, no eyewitnesses. Even the shotgun shells found conveniently at each crime scene didn't match the shotgun shells that I owned.
Were you there that night?
No, I wasn't. Everything was predicated on hearsay and circumstantial evidence.
Why do you believe the police arrested you?
Because of my past, because of my history. I was the co-founder of the Crips. I was someone that whenever anything happened, pretty much in L.A. or in Compton, for instance, as an example, in Compton, the Compton Armory had been broken into and quite a few weapons were missing. And, of course, they automatically assumed that I had something to do with it or I knew of someone who... broke in there, and I was submitted. I was subjected to two lie detector tests.
And yet, they still arrested you.
Oh yes, oh yes. I've been picked up for many strange cases. Some I even had Johnny Cochran had to represent me for a attempted robbery on two individuals who. In a sense, were broken than I was. They were more destitute than I was, but yet still, I attempted to rob them.
Laura Owens, the stepmother of U.S. Army veteran Albert Owens, one of the four people... The stepmother says that you're a cold-blooded murderer. They want to sweep it under the rug. Your response?
Well, I forgive her for her misquotes because, for one thing... I understand how the prosecutors and the AGs, the attorney generals, have a tendency to fill their heads with a unilateral version of the truth. The fact of the matter is that she's all this time, or throughout all these years, I guarantee you that her and other people have not delved into every shred of evidence, all of the transcripts, all of the appeals. She has a unilateral version of what has taken place. So quite naturally, she's going to favor the prosecutor. But I guarantee you, if she and others were to take the time and to read the transcripts and to view everything with an objective mind, I guarantee you that the results and their thinking would be entirely different. And plus, the fact of the matter is that I understand her grief. I express regret for anyone who has lost a loved one, any victim.
Stanley Williams, can you describe where we're talking to you right now?
Well, I'm on San Quentin's death row. I'm in a cell that's probably 9x4 or 9x5 feet, or foot, rather. And there's a steel sink, there's a steel toilet, there's a steel bunk, there's a steel shelf, there's a light fixture. And on the bars, is on the outside of the bars, is a mesh fence.
You have been at San Quentin for more than half your life?
Yes, yes, unfortunately so. Quite pathetic.
Can you talk about your time there? Can you talk about the beginning, the years in solitary confinement, and what you've done?
Well, I can quite net. I can easily demythologize the thought that, well, the person when he goes to prison, of course they'll change. They're locked up, but that's not so, because I was incorrigible from the moment I got here all the way up to 1988. So that debunks that theory. And once I was in solitary confinement, it provided me with the isolated moments to reflect on my past and to dwell upon something greater, something better than involving myself in thuggery and criminality. It had to be more to life than that. It had to be more than the madness that was disseminating throughout this entire prison.
And so when do you feel like you started to change?
And between the years of 1988 to 1994, and it's a continuous and it's an incessant reality for me. My redemptive transition began in solitary confinement, and unlike other people who express their experiences of an epiphany or a satori, I never experienced anything of that ilk. That wouldn't have been enough. I often tell people that I didn't have a 360-degree turnaround. I had a 720-degree turnaround. It took me twice as much. Just one spin around wouldn't have done it. I was that messed up, that lost, that menticided, brainwashed. So I was able to gradually, in a piecemeal fashion, change my life. Slowly but surely, through education, through edification, through spiritual cultivation, battling my demons, and eventually that led to me embracing redemption.
And what does embracing redemption mean? Can you talk about your writing? Can you talk about what you've done?
Well, my interpretation of redemption, it differs from the theological or the academical rendition. I believe that my redemption symbolizes the end of a bad beginning and a new start. It goes beyond, in a sense, of being liberated from one's sins or atonement in itself. I feel that my redemption mostly or primarily encompasses the ability to reach out to others. I call it, when people say spirituality, I break it down as a spirit act, with spirit being the pneuma, the soul, the id, et cetera, and the duality aspect of it being an act, a performance, a deed. So we're talking about a spirit act, and a spirit act towards helping other people, which are primarily youths in my case.
And what is the message that you are trying to send? Who are you talking to among the youth in this country?
Well, I'm talking to any youth who are considered to be or deemed to be at risk or even hinting around being a thug or a criminal of any type of genre. I mostly propagate education and the need for it, because to me that is the terra firma in which any human being must stand in order to survive in this country or to survive anywhere in the world, and dealing, you know, with every aspect of civilization, every aspect of surviving. Education is very important. It took me all these years to discern that, but now I do.
Stanley Williams, can you talk about why you started the Crips?
Well, I mean, I've stated it in my memoir, Blue Rage Black Redemption, that we started out, at least my intent, was to, in a sense, address all the so-called neighboring gangs in the area. And to put, in a sense, I thought I can cleanse the neighborhood of all these, marauding gangs. But yeah, I was totally wrong. And eventually we morphed into the monster we were addressing.
In what way?
Well, we became a gang. We became exactly what I had odium for, which were gangs, street gangs. I mean, they became a pest. They were a pest. Every time I looked up, my friends were being preyed upon. And when I came from camp, I decided to create something that would deal with them, to put them in their place. I mean, it's really ironic because we did too good of a job, and we morphed into what we were fighting, what we were battling against.
Stanley Williams, your critics say you might be running the Crips from death row. What is your response to that?
Well, I say that whomever says that, whatever institution or singular person says that, that you must take that and society must take that with a grain of salt. I say that because of the simple fact that I have documentation in which, if you know my editor of the books, of my children's books, Ms. Barbara Becknell, she can forward you or email you the chronicles that I received from the Institutional Classification Committee that commended me on my positive program over the last 10 years, and that's dated in August 5th, 2004. So that, in a sense, contradicts anything that anyone is saying. What they're saying, these lies, these spurious allegations that these people are throwing out there, are just something that they're putting out there in order to exacerbate, to expedite my execution. I mean, any time that they can make it appear as though I'm still a monster, then society will say, well, kill him. It facilitates my death. Common sense. That's what it does. That's what these people have been trying to do for the last 5 years with impetus. This is what they've been doing.
Stanley Williams, what are you most proud of in your life?
Other than writing the children's books and my memoir, my redemption and my change. I never thought ever that I'd be able to change because of the simple fact...
You have 120 seconds left on this call.
Thuggery was all I knew. I lived it. I breathed it. Being a Crip was all I knew. I thought there was nothing else. I dreaded life after Cripping. I dreaded that. But I say to any individual who's in a gang that if you have enough courage to get into a gang, you should have equally enough or even more to get out of it.
As you can hear, we just have a minute to go unless you can call us back. What message do you want people in this country to hear right now, and the governor, if you were meeting with him yourself?
Well, once again, I must say that I am innocent, and I understand that it's difficult for a person who is poor, a person who has a criminal background as I have.
You have 60 seconds left on this call.
A person who is black, a person who is minority, it is very, very difficult for an individual to obtain justice, as I've seen. It's very difficult. And I feel that justice should not be predicated on a person's creed or color or race or social stratum or intellectual prowess or any of that.
Could you call us back?
I will try. And if I do, I only have a few minutes.
We'd appreciate that.
Okay. Will do.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Stanley Tookie Williams, speaking to us from death row in San Quentin in a rare extended interview. When we come back, he calls us back. Stay with us. Sly and the Family Stone here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting in close to 400 radio and TV stations around the country, Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM, and college radio stations, as well as on PBS stations and public access TV stations. We're also on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, where you can see the video and photographs of this broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman as we return now to our rare interview with Stanley Tookie Williams from death row in San Quentin, California. He's scheduled to die on December 13th. I reached him on the phone last night. We had to record the interview in two parts because the prison cuts off each conversation after 15 minutes. Stanley Williams?
Yes, it is.
Thank you for rejoining us.
Oh, well, as long as I can.
Where did you get the nickname Tookie?
That is not a nickname. That is my middle name. My mother gave me that. In fact, that was my father's middle name as well. And I believe it's my grandfather's middle name. But I know it's my father's for a fact. Stanley Tookie Williams III.
December 13th is just 2 weeks away from this conversation.
Yes, it is.
What are your thoughts facing your death?
I have none. In other words, I continue to live my life day by day, or shall I say minute by minute, hour by hour, and day by day as I've been doing since my redemption. It has nothing to do with a cavalier attitude. It has nothing to do with machismo or manhood or some pseudo code of the streets, which I formerly used. It has to do with my faith in God and my redemption. That's why I can sit here and talk to you just as calmly or any of the other journalists who have crossed my path. I don't fear this type of stuff. I'm at peace. And when you're in a sense...
This call and your telephone number will be recorded and monitored.
And when you maintain this sense of peace and you live by a truth, by integrity, these things don't bother me. It doesn't. I've been experiencing moribund-type experiences most of my life. I could have died many a times. I could have died when I was shot. I could have died when I was shot at by the police and rival gang members. There are many opportunities for me to die. Of course, I don't want to die. I mean, after my redemption, I have what I consider to be a joie de vivre. So, I have an enjoyment, a love for life. So that's why I can calmly sit here and speak to you or anyone else with peace in my heart and peace in my mind. I don't get rattled. Nothing can rattle me. Nothing will ever rattle me. I've been rattled the majority of my life.
I asked you what you are most proud of in your life. What do you most regret?
Creating the Crips. That is my. I rue that more than anything.
You managed to strike a peace accord. How did you maneuver that between the Crips and the Bloods?
Well, the fact that a person such as me, of my ilk, who deemed the opposing gang as an eternal enemy, it wasn't hard for people to believe me because they knew where I stood. There was no clandestine or latent messages. Everybody knew where I stood. And for me to come out and say that what we were doing was wrong, it was believable. That's why people didn't, or at least the gang members didn't discredit my propensity and my alacrity for peace. That's why it was embraced with sincerity by those who I knew and those I didn't know. On both sides of the fence.
Stanley Williams, what does it mean to have the level of support that you have right now?
It's God-inspiring to me, awe-inspiring. It's excellent. I'm exceptionally grateful. I never expected it. The majority of my life I've fought, especially in here, alone. I even had to fight against appellate attorneys, that I had representing me who were not qualified. I had one attorney who was a job litigator, in the federal level. And she'd been on that for like 3 years. And this woman was coming to represent me for 4 murders. Then they had a guy to represent me. He only represented me for 6 months because after that he had to end up leaving and going to Ireland somewhere. Now, he knew prior to that he had an engagement, but yet he took the case, allowing me to think that he was going to be permanent. He said he was going to be permanent. But yet and still, he left within 6 months. As a matter of fact, it was 5.5 months in which he left. So these are the things, these are the type of representations that I was getting. Attorneys who would file a brief, a 45-page brief with over 120 typos in it, and telling me that, the judge wouldn't, it doesn't matter, they won't look at that. Of course they'll look at that, and they'll use that against me, not her, me.
What are your thoughts on the death penalty in general?
Well, the death penalty, it's not a system of justice. It is a system of so-called system of justice that perpetuates a... shall I say, a vindictive type of response, a vigilante type of aura about it. We're talking about something that is barbaric. We're talking about something that it doesn't deter anything. I mean, if it did, then there wouldn't be so many people, especially in California. We're talking about over 650 individuals on death row. And if it was a deterrent, this place wouldn't be filled like this. And it's an expensive ordeal that the money, as you know, the monetary means comes out of the taxpayer's pocket. And for anyone to think that murder can be resolved by murdering, it's ridiculous. I mean, we look at all the wars that we have throughout other countries and other nations, and all it does is this violence, all it does is engender violence. There seems to be no end but a continuous cycle, an incessant process of blood and gore that doesn't end. And through violence, you can't possibly obtain peace. You can, in a sense, occupy a belief of peace. In other words, through this mechanism of violence, it appears that because there is a standing army or a standing police that is using brutality or violence, or a system that uses brutality or violence, that is going to totally eliminate or stop criminous behavior or criminous minds or killings or what have you. But it doesn't.
Stanley Williams.
There has to be another way.
Do you ever imagine yourself being free?
In my dreams. In my dreams, I've envisioned my liberation many of times. Matter of fact, I was telling an individual the other day that in my dreams, whenever I run into some albatross or some type of dilemma, I seem to float away from it. And in my mind, that is a sense of freedom. That is a sense of avoiding, eschewing, or shunning any type of madness.
Do you know how the state plans to kill you?
Well, if I don't, I'd have to be living in a cave somewhere.
How will they do it?
Well, the intravenous use of needles and things of that nature.
Are they preparing you for this now?
Preparing me?
Yes.
Well, yes, I'm in a different area. I used to be in East Block, and now I'm in North Sag, so yes, they are, of course. In their minds, it's a done deal.
And in your mind?
I'm sure they're looking forward to it because they've come out propagating that I should be executed. Isn't that amazing? This is unprecedented for the CDC or San Quentin Prison to come out against an individual. It's never been done before in the history of this institution or the history of CDC. But yet they've come out.
Can you explain what you mean?
Well, I mean, there are individuals, they have, like, for instance, the San Quentin spokesperson, he spoke out. He said, even on 60 Minutes, they did a program about me, and he stated that I deserve to be executed. Now, I believe that's taking your job too far. And at one time, they had a lot of spurious allegations on the CDC website, which they had to take off because the former San Quentin warden, Vasquez, he stated that San Quentin appears to be trying to promote death by getting into this. They're supposed to be impartial. Their job is only to execute me, not to exacerbate by drumming up the need, the protest, or the remonstration for me to be executed, but that's what they've been doing. I'm the only human being that's ever been on death row that they've ever put forth effort to execute.
If Governor Schwarzenegger grants you executive clemency, what will you do? What are your plans? What do you want
so many
to accomplish?
Things. I'm glad. Excellent question. Glad you asked that. The thing is recently I had a visit with Bruce Gordon. He is the president and CEO of the NAACP. I had a visit with him on the 25th, Friday. And we've established a partnership to create a violence prevention curriculum for at-risk youth throughout America. And each of the chapters of NAACP are implementing this program. And he's going around the country promoting this and apprising people. So I'm not sitting back on my laurels, believe me. I have things to do. I have books that I haven't even completed that I'm still working on. Matter of fact, I'm working on Thoughts of Thunder. It's a compilation of essays on a variety of topics. And I'm working on a female gang. It's called Female Gangs, The Forgotten Gender. And a few other books. I'm doing some more children's books, some other children's books as well. So, believe me, I would be working on this, and my attorneys, will be helping me strive to inevitably prove my innocence.
Do you think you could be granted a new trial?
You have 120 seconds left on this call.
Well, that's dealing in hypotheticals, and I don't deal with hypotheticals. I can only say that I pray that I get a new trial. I pray that I get whatever is necessary to spare my life so that I can continue to strive in order to prove my innocence.
And if you still spent the rest of your life in jail, do you think it would be worth being spared the death penalty?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, where there's life, there's the ability to continuously strive to do whatever your purpose is or goal is in life. So, yes, if I'm alive, I can always strive forward to prove my innocence, regardless of how long it takes. Even up to the last second of my life, when I'm 100 or whatever, you know what I mean? So,
you have 60 seconds left on this call.
As I stated earlier in the conversation, that I have Zawadi V. So, with this love of life, I have it. I assume that was forced down to me from my ancestors. So.
Well, in this last seconds that we have, they're yours. What do you have to say?
Well, I want to thank you for allowing me to be able to express my thoughts and feelings, and that as long as I have breath, I will continue to do what I can to proliferate a positive message throughout this country and abroad to youths everywhere of all colors, gender, and geographical area. And I will continue to do what I can to help. I want to be a part of the salute.
With that, the phone cut off. Stanley Tookie Williams had his allotted 15-minute phone call from San Quentin Prison from his cell. He is scheduled to die on December 13th. On December 8th, his defense team will meet with the governor of California, Schwarzenegger, for him to consider clemency for Stanley Tookie Williams. Today around the world, there are actions, vigils, protests in support of Stanley Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We will continue to follow this case. When we come back, we'll go to Iraq to find out about the four Christian peacemakers who have been kidnapped. Stay with us.
She's gone away from
Lonesome Journey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Christian Peacemaker team has confirmed that four of their peace activists working with the group were kidnapped in Baghdad on Saturday. The aid workers have been identified as 54-year-old Tom Fox of Clearbrook, Virginia, James Loney of Toronto, 31, 32-year-old Harmeet Singh Sudan of Canada, and Norman Kember of Britain. He's 74 years old. On Tuesday, the Arab television network Al Jazeera broadcast a videotape of the four men sitting cross-legged against a wall with their hands behind their backs. The video bears the insignia of a group calling itself the Swords of Righteousness Brigade. In the tape, the men identified themselves on camera.
My name is Norman Kember. I am 74, and I'm a member of the Christian Peacemaking Team in Iraq.
My name is Harmeet Sudan. I'm 32, and I'm working on a volunteer for CPT in Iraq.
My name is James Loney. I am 41 years old. I am from Canada, and I am part of the Christian Peacemaker Team in Iraq.
My name is Tom Fox. I'm 54 years old. I'm from the United States, and I'm a member of Christian Peacemaker Teams in Iraq.
In a statement that accompanied the video, the four men were accused of being undercover spies working as Christian peace activists. The Christian Peacemakers team said in a statement, quote, "We're angry because what has happened to our teammates is the result of the actions of the U.S. and U.K. government due to the illegal attack on Iraq and the continuing occupation and oppression of its people." The Christian Peacemakers team is a non-missionary group that has been documenting the abuse of Iraqi detainees and working with their families. They were the first people to publicly denounce the torture of Iraqis at the hands of U.S. forces long before the media revealed what was happening at Abu Ghraib. In fact, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker magazine, who helped expose the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004, cited the organization in his articles. We reached Seymour Hersh last night and asked him about the Christian Peacemakers team.
I ran across them when I was looking into the torture issue and at Abu Ghraib, and I remember distinctly that they were on a cutting edge. I talked to people in the organization who had been active for years in total, you know, under the radar of all of us because they didn't have photographs. They were very interested, for example, very early on in the unwarranted use of dogs in interrogations by American troops. And most of the things that I ended up writing about in Abu Ghraib, most of the general concepts they knew a great deal about earlier, as did Human Rights Watch and Amnesty. So these are people toiling really for the good of the Iraqi people, and often in, as I say, in obscurity in terms of the mainstream media.
Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The New Yorker magazine. We go now to Baghdad to speak with Greg Rollins. He's a member of the Christian Peacemakers team. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to have you with us. What is the latest news you've heard about the four peace activists that you work with?
Well, at this point in time, it's the same, I think, as what everybody else knows. We saw the footage, and that's where it's at. We have not heard anything since that time.
Greg, can you tell us what you're doing in Iraq?
Our work here has been to document human rights abuses, to put a face on the Iraqi people and to get out their voice. That's something that, you know, you don't see a lot in the mainstream media, and that's, we feel we have that advantage. We're out on the streets, we talk to the common people on the streets, and so we try and get their voice out. We escort, you know, Iraqis who feel threatened at times. We host these delegations that come in, and so people can actually see what's happening and then go home and tell their home communities what is actually happening in Iraq. These are some of the things that we've been doing here.
Greg, the statement that came out with the videotape of your four colleagues who are kidnapped said that they are undercover spies that are masquerading as Christian peace activists. Your response?
Our response is no, we're not spies, and I think a lot of people are supporting that we are not spies. A lot of our Iraqi friends have been making statements and getting them on the news stating that we are not spies. A lot of Muslim friends of ours from throughout the world, and of course, Western
groups, peace activist groups, the human rights groups, a lot of reporters we've worked with have all, you know, stood up and said, well, we're not spies. And I mean, even if you just look at the men on TV, I mean, Norman does not look like a spy. And if you've ever met Tom Fox, I mean, he's the last person on earth you'd think of as being a spy, because he's just not that kind of person. So I think these allegations are, I mean, they're false, and it's quite distressing, and we're very worried for our friends, and hope that, you know, that they're not harmed and that they're released soon.
Greg, what are you doing to free your four teammates of the Christian Peace Team?
Well, like I said, we've been having a lot of our friends, we've been asking a lot of our Iraqi friends to stand up and you know, support the fact that we are not spies and that we are doing human rights work here and trying to spread, you know, educate people about what is actually happening in Iraq, and what we're trying to do is very positive. And that's been the first step, is just getting Iraqis to stand up for us like that. And the second step has been getting other people to do so. A big part of it is waiting to see what exactly comes next.
And what do you say to those who say, well, this is a Christian missionary group in Iraq?
Not at all. I mean, we're not a missionary group. We do not proselytize. It's not what we do. We believe that the best way to display our faith is through actions, and those actions are helping people. We have no desire to convert anybody to Christianity or to take them away from their previous religion. That's not in our interest. Our interest is to simply help people who are oppressed.
You have expressed anger at Britain and the United States in the statement you released. Why?
Well, the Britain and the U.S. have stirred up this animosity towards the West. I mean, there was animosity there before that, but they've certainly brought that on a lot more by attacking Iraq. I mean, a lot of people throughout the world, if not the Middle East, are furious that Iraq is under occupation right now. And, of course, one of the reason I think that my teammates were kidnapped was because there is so much animosity right now towards the West. And so a lot of people can be viewed as being spies. And I think that this is one of those cases. I think the fact that so many people are angry at the U.S. and Britain is just made this possible.
Greg Rollins, I want to thank you for being with us. We will continue to follow this case of your four teammates of the Christian Peacemakers Team kidnapped in Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to Peru and to U.S. citizen Lori Berenson. Today marks the 10th anniversary of her arrest in Lima. On November 30th, 1995, she was arrested on a public bus in downtown Lima, accused of collaborating with the rebel group MRTA. With a gun held to her head, a hooded military tribunal sentenced the longtime American activist to life in prison for, quote, treason against the fatherland. 4.5 years later, due to international pressure, Lori's sentence was vacated. She was retried by a civilian court, which reduced her sentence to 20 years. Lori Berenson has consistently maintained her innocence. In 2002, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights declared neither of her trials complied with international standards, and they violated her rights to due process. Because Peru refused to comply with the commission's recommendations, the commission brought Lori Berenson's case before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. In 2004, the court, which was seen as one of her last avenues of appeal, upheld her imprisonment. A Peruvian judge on that court boasted how he had convinced his fellow justices to overturn the commission's ruling. On this 10th anniversary of her arrest, Lori Berenson has released a statement from her prison cell. Her father, Mark Berenson, came to her firehouse studio yesterday to read the words of his jailed daughter, Lori.
My name is Lori Berenson. I'm a New York-born and raised political prisoner in Peru. I've spent many years in Central and South America trying to contribute to the efforts of those who seek social justice for all. I continue this work from prison. On November 30, 1995, I was pulled off a public bus in Lima. Like thousands of Peruvians, I was detained by the anti-terrorist police, tried for treason by a hooded military tribunal under draconian anti-terrorism laws, and condemned to life in prison. prison. This all occurred in the context of an internal conflict in Peru that began in the early 80s with the armed insurgents of the Shining Path and later the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement. When I was arrested, Peruvian President Fujimori made me a symbol for his anti-terrorist campaign. His ability to use the media for his own publicity purposes led to my case being very high profile. Because of the tireless efforts of my family, friends, and many others, the Fujimori regime was forced to retry me in a civilian court. In 2001, I was sentenced to 20 years for collaboration. In 2004, in light of the international anti-terrorism campaign in our post-9/11 world and under extreme pressure from Peru's political class, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ratified my sentence. The details of what happened to me are irrelevant in the broader picture of the thousands of Peruvians who have been killed, disappeared, tortured, and detained during this internal conflict. Since history has always been rewritten by those who have the upper hand, the issue of subversion became the scapegoat for all of Peru's problems. In all parts of the world, symbolic culprits are used to obscure the root causes of social discontent, to distract attention and distort realities when any group of people question the existing order. The world order, especially in this era of globalized capitalism, is designed to benefit a powerful few at the expense of the majority of our world's peoples. This system is unjust, immoral, terrifying, and just plain insane. We must change it. People all over the world are imprisoned today and suffering tremendous injustices for challenging this order. I express my solidarity with all of those prisoners, and in particular my admiration for those whose courage we can hear in the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal, in the writings about Leonard Peltier, in the struggle for the liberation of Puerto Rico, and many others. For prisoners, the struggle for basic dignity is a daily plight. Prisons are just a smaller version of the general system that operates in this world, and that is what is wrong. The desire to change it is why many of us are here in the first place. It is a worthy cause to be behind bars for.
The words of Laurie Berenson, read by her father, Mark Berenson. Laurie is in prison in Peru. She has served 10 years, has another 10 years to go, scheduled for release in 2015, just shy of her 46th birthday. She would be released. You can go to our website at democracynow.org, and there you can click on the full hour and a half interview I did with Laurie as the first journalist to get into her prison in Peru. I spoke with her a few years ago, Laurie Berenson, in her own words. That's democracynow.org. Her website is Free Laurie. That's L-O-R-I. .org, and we will link to that as well as to the information about Stanley Tookie Williams at our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Transcripts, video, audio, and photos are at our website, democracynow.org. Let others know where they can get this daily grassroots global newscast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.